You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And yet I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge the considerable controversy that your generous decision has generated. In part, this is because I am at the beginning and not the end of my labors on the world stage. But perhaps the most profound issue surrounding my receipt of this prize is the fact that I am the commander-in-chief of a military, of a nation, in the midst of two wars.
The decision to award the 2009 Nobel Peace Prize to Barack Obama was met in some quarters with ridicule, shock, most often confusion. How could a sitting president mired in two wars be awarded a prize whose main goal is the promotion of worldwide peace? It's a paradox that President Obama touched on in his acceptance speech, which we just heard a clip from, and one that Stephen L. Carter, the Wilson Nelson Cromwell Professor of Law at Yale, takes as the jumping-off point for his latest book, The Violence of Peace, America's Wars in the Age of Obama. It's an examination of the president's views on war and peace and what they mean for the future of American military excursions. Peace Books is the publisher, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Professor Carter back to our show. Hi.
It's good to be back. Thanks for having me.
The last couple of times you were here was to discuss novels you've written.
I know.
What got you back to writing about political theory?
You know, I've wanted to write a book about just and unjust wars for a long time. I teach in the field. I've done a lot of articles in the field. And when President Obama gave that speech in December of 2009, I put aside the other things I was working on and I said, I really want to sit down and do this, because he talked in that speech about the theory of just and unjust wars, which is something we don't hear presidents talk about very much. We talk about national security and national interest and we've got to win. But to think about war from the point of view of moral conversation, I think we should be supporting the president of that. Whatever one's view is or the partisan side of any issue, to bring reflective moral conversation to the question of war and peace, I think is crucial.
So let's listen to that clip. If we can, that in which he argues, articulates the theory known as just war.
And over time, as codes of law sought to control violence within groups, so did philosophers and clerics and statesmen seek to regulate the destructive power of war. The concept of a just war emerged, suggesting that war is justified only when certain conditions were met. If it is waged as a last resort or in self-defense, if the force used is proportional, and if, whenever possible, civilians are spared from violence.
So what do you think that Obama is saying there?
I think that what we find the president inviting us to do is to take seriously the following problem. When is it right to go to war? I don't mean when do we want to go to war. I mean, when is it right? If you think about it, when we go to war, we send men and women into harm's way. We ask them to die for us and to kill for us. And we do it so often in an atmosphere of partisanship and backbiting. It strikes me that that's the time to have really thoughtful political conversations that are so difficult to have in America.
You say that St. Augustine was the intellectual progenitor of just war thinking. What did he argue? And was he arguing for something like the Crusades as a just war?
Augustine, when he talked about just war, was not arguing for something like the Crusades. What Augustine really was saying was that the use of violence, that is the willingness to kill someone else, is such a deep violation of moral law that we should only do it in the most extreme circumstances. What's really interesting about Augustine applied today is Augustine thought the highest form of warfare was when you fought not to defend yourself, but for someone else, for the protection of someone who was helpless, suffering under attack. That was the highest form, the most moral form, he thought, of violence. And oddly, today we think of it the other way around. We think of self-defense as the thing that's easy to justify, and we think of protecting other suffering people in the world as something difficult to justify.
He talked about right intention. But isn't that to some degree the argument that some people used for attacking Iraq? They said getting beyond the weapons of mass destruction, all that. Saddam Hussein, they were comparing him to Hitler.
Whenever we're about to fight a war, we do hear all sorts of extreme language. That was true in Iraq. It's true in a way in Afghanistan. It's true if you look at earlier wars, World War II, if you look at Vietnam, look at various wars. You'll always find an extreme rhetoric to stir people up, to get them excited and angry and passionate about this need to kill. And what I'm suggesting is that if we're going to fight wars, and we're the biggest superpower, the only superpower, we spend 40 cents of every defense dollar on the face of the earth is spent by the United States. If we're going to fight wars, we have to find a way to do it that allows us to have conversations about it that are actually conversations about right and wrong.
Most people felt that World War II was a just war, but hasn't there been disagreement over almost every other one we've had, at least since World War II?
I think it's fair to say
World War I as well.
Interestingly, even World War II generated a lot of domestic opposition. Now, in those days, we used to punish people still for opposition to war in ways people can't even imagine when they complain today. But there was some of that. World War II is seen as just war in two reasons. First, most obviously, because it put an end to the Holocaust. In addition, because Nazism as a force had to be stopped. And I think there's widespread agreement about that.
And we were also attacked at Pearl Harbor.
We were attacked by the Japanese at Pearl Harbor, and it was also a war of self-defense. People look at Afghanistan today the same way. The World Trade Centers were attacked.
Is 9/11 equivalent to the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor?
It doesn't matter if it's—
The government of Afghanistan wasn't involved in that attack.
It's not so much whether it's equivalent or not. I'm not suggesting that you can't fight any war unless it's World War II. It's rather that if we're going to think seriously about when to use our forces— what one wants is for the president, President Bush before, President Obama now, to make a case that allows us to somehow be reflective and thoughtful in response. In fact, if you look at Afghanistan, take that one example. President Obama has said about Afghanistan, I'm quoting him here, he said it's a war of necessity, a war that's forced on us, a war of self-defense, and a war we must win. He's used all of those phrases. If that's what he believes about Afghanistan, then it strikes me that it's what he's trying, in a sense, to have a foot in two camps by saying we must win and we must withdraw. When Vice President Biden in Iraq just made the comment the other day that we're not really, 2014 is not a firm deadline, I think he's getting something very important. If the war in Afghanistan is so important to the president, they think, has an obligation to give a serious speech articulating with passion the reasons he thinks we have to win, and more important, because we've been there a long time now, what counts as a win, how we know when the war is over.
Well, when he ran for president, he seemed to be giving two separate messages. He came across as the anti-war president. At the same time, he was pro going ahead with more force in Afghanistan.
It's true, and it was always quite striking, because I think a lot of the people who voted for him, obviously he had a big constituency of people who were against the war in Iraq, but I think a lot of people also thought he would probably end the war in Afghanistan sooner, and maybe the war on terror too. What people have discovered since Obama's election, some people have been unhappy about it, some have been delighted about it, is that his policies on war are not that different from the policies of his predecessor, George W. Bush. That whatever may be their difference on domestic policy and other aspects of foreign policy, with respect to war, the Obama administration looks a lot like the Bush administration. They largely followed President Bush's plans for the staged withdrawal of Iraq. They largely followed President Bush's strategy in Afghanistan, and they've actually doubled down on the Bush strategy for the war on terror. President Obama has done things that Bush never did. So, for example, drone attacks have become far more common across that entire region than they were under the Bush administration. There are many other examples as well.
Well, he okayed possible assassination of American citizens like al-Awlaki.
And al-Awlaki is an interesting character. He seems to be running the al-Qaeda offshoot in Yemen, or at least helping to run it, and has planned attacks against the United States. But he's still an American citizen. And so the question whether the president of the United States should authorize the assassination of an American citizen, I think, is a question that requires really thoughtful conversation and not just the assumption on some sides, well, it's war, he can do what he wants, or on the other side, perhaps the opposite.
He's also hasn't cut back on presidential powers, as some people had expected. Hasn't rendition actually been expanded a bit?
There are some news accounts suggesting that rendition, that is the sending of people to other countries for interrogation, has been expanded. It's a little unclear, but it does appear that the United States government is capturing suspects, well, enemies, soldiers, whatever you want to call them, on the battlefield, and more often than the previous administration, sending them to other countries for interrogation.
My guest is Stephen L. Carter. His latest book, The Violence of Peace, America's Wars in the Age of Obama, published by Beast Books. Why do you think the Nobel Committee awarded President Obama the prize so early in his career? Do you think it was an attempt to influence the way he might proceed with the two wars he was involved with?
It might have been that, but what I like about the decision to give President Obama the Nobel Prize is it let him give that speech, because the speech that President Obama gave, which it's reprinted as an appendix in the back of the book, and it's a speech that Americans should listen to or read. I cannot remember as thoughtful a speech about the morality of war by an American leader in many, many decades. And I think you could read that speech. You could be a Republican, you'd be a Democrat, you could be pro-war, you could be anti-war, and you would see that this is someone who is trying to cope in a serious way with a moral challenge of being president of the United States. That is, the moral challenge of sending young people to kill and to die on our behalf. And I think that we, the citizens of the United States, owe the president at least this much, whether we're for him or against him. We owe him a serious and reflective dialogue without trying to take partisan advantage on the issue of war.
I was confused by one thing you wrote. Obama's election overturned a bit of conventional wisdom that Americans had never, in the midst of war, elected an anti-war candidate. Well, maybe to some degree that's true, but didn't Eisenhower promise to end the Korean War when he ran for president? And didn't Nixon say he had a plan to get us out of Vietnam?
Yes, all that is true, and that's why I said it was a conventional wisdom that was wrong. If you look at a lot of the commentary in 07 to 08, there were people – you can go back and look this up. I cite some of them who suggested that Obama couldn't win because Americans during a war would not vote for an anti-war candidate. And I'm agreeing with you that actually they've done it all through history. Even Lincoln in 1860, people forget, was running as an anti-war candidate. He was saying that there wouldn't be a war if he was elected. And Roosevelt said he wouldn't involve us in what people were calling the European War when he was running for re-election in 1936.
It's only once we're in the middle of a war that people are reluctant to vote against the person in charge. Many people said they voted for George Bush in the second election because they didn't want to change horses in midstream.
Yeah, actually, you know, it's actually Abraham Lincoln who began using that phrase in politics to refer to the problem of changing a leader in the middle of war. It was Lincoln who said, when asked how he got reelected in 1864 when everyone thought he was going to lose, that's what he said, that I guess they didn't want to change horses in the middle of the stream. There's something to that, but what happens with wars, at first when America fights a war, it's happened over and over again, people, even if they didn't support the war, they want to win, they have a certain degree of excitement about it, and maybe they'll elect the president once. But if a war drags on, the longer a war gets, the less supportive people are. And it's easy to forget, looking back at the history now, that even with World War II, which had a lot of public support, by early 1944, support for at least the European part of the war was really sagging in the United States. And there were a lot of people who were saying at the time, maybe we should have just fought Japan and not fought in Europe. Fortunately, we didn't listen to them.
Many people have talked about how impossible it is to get any bipartisan stuff through in Washington. But you argue that in this one area, Obama has been successful in building bridges and working bipartisanly in his war policy.
I think that's right. It is a terrible thing, the inability of people in Washington to work together. It's ruinous to our politics. And sometimes they're egged on by, you know, talk shows. This one accepted, but you know what I'm talking about. And I don't place the blame on one party or the other. They're both actually pretty bad on this. They both love to take partisan advantage of whatever the latest tragedy or horror or wonder has been. But in the case of war, I think we're doing a little better with the war than we've done on some other issues. I'd like to see us do better still, because I think that war is the last place we should be trying to take partisan advantage. And historically, if you look at American history, on the occasions we've tried to make partisan advantage out of war, we have all kinds of domestic cataclysm as a result.
My guest is Stephen L. Carter, the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Law at Yale, where he's taught for almost 30 years. He is the author of four best-selling novels and many works of nonfiction. His most recent nonfiction, The Violence of Peace, America's Wars in the Age of Obama, published by Beast Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Stephen L. Carter. His latest book, The Violence of Peace, America's Wars in the Age of Obama, published by Beast Books. Aren't there two components to just war? Forgive my Latin, jus ad bellum, justice for war, and jus in bellum, justice in war? What's the distinction?
There are two components, and the president made brief reference to both. The idea is that, first of all, you have to have a just cause. It has to be a last resort. You have to have exhausted other means and so on. That's one side of just war thinking. And a lot of times in America, when we think about whether war is just, we ask ourselves only that question. Is there a good enough reason to go to war? But the second component is just as important, the notion that the president mentioned that you can't target civilians, but it's more than that. It's that you have to use an amount of force that is proportionate to the harm you've suffered and the justice you're trying to achieve. You're not supposed to use more force than is necessary because the killing itself presents a serious moral problem, even if it's necessary to kill, which obviously it is if you're going to fight a war.
By those criteria, was Judge H.W. Bush's Gulf War a just war?
Well, there's been a lot of debate about that over the years. The Gulf War, to push Saddam Hussein's forces out of Kuwait, certainly that Iraq had violated international law by crossing the border and taking over a sovereign country.
And achieved its goal.
But undoing that has always been understood to be a proper part of just war. The main just war question that arose during the Gulf War was the decision by the United States and its allies to bomb the Iraqi troops who were retreating back toward the border. I want to make very clear, that did not violate international law. Under international law, until they surrender, they're still combatants. You can shoot at them. But as a matter of just war, as a matter of thing what's morally right as opposed to legally right, I think we should all be a little uneasy about the notion of sending bombers after troops that are actively retreating.
We talked earlier about vilifying the person we're going to war with. But doesn't just war thinking include the idea that evil exists in the world? And that's one of the reasons that Saddam Hussein was often compared to Hitler?
It's certainly the case that if you're going to fight a just war, in the end it comes down to good versus evil in the following sense. Only one side can be just. So if the president says, as he has, that we are in the right in Afghanistan, that's a just war, that means the other side is fighting unjustly. And the president, in a lot of his speeches, not just the Nobel speech, has used phrases suggesting that he believes that true evil exists in the world. I don't know if the listeners remember when the six CIA employees were blown up in Kandahar in Afghanistan a year ago. The president spoke at the memorial service in February 2010, and he talked about eliminating enemies before they can strike us. That's language very reminiscent of the way that President Bush used to speak about the same sort of thing. The president's actions and his words, at least with respect to Afghanistan and the war on terror, suggest he really believes we're in the right and the other side is completely in the wrong.
Well, in this whole matter of evil, we were allies with one of the most evil people that ever lived, Joseph Stalin, in World War II. And then suddenly we were enemies with Joseph Stalin.
And actually, we were once allies of Saddam Hussein as well. That is, if you look historically, we've often allied ourselves with bad people, which may be necessary sometimes to win a war. Look at Afghanistan. So if you look at the Karzai government in Afghanistan, it's a government that is, in a sense, indefensibly corrupt. Afghanistan is run for the benefit of the whatever particular clan is in power. They divvy up the goods, so to speak. And everybody knows that. On the other hand, that's who you've got. You can't suddenly decide, well, we're only going to fight where we can be allied with democracies. You're not going to win a lot of wars that way. And maybe we should fight fewer wars, but there are places in the world that are in terrible need. And you look at places like Darfur in southern Sudan, where they're having the referendum right now on whether to secede. The horrors that have been wreaked on the southern Sudan need a military response, which so far the West is unwilling to give.
But there are so many other places where we can talk about evil. North Korea, Burma, Zimbabwe, and we can go on and on and on. We never went to war with South Africa during the apartheid years.
And the fact that you can't do everything is not a reason to do nothing. The reason I single out Sudan is because there you have actual genocide going on. That is, that's not simply an oppressive regime. That's people being killed for being of a different religion and a different tribe.
So should we have gone into Rwanda?
I think we should have gone into Rwanda, and President Clinton has even said he thinks that the greatest mistake he made in his presidency was not intervening in Rwanda. There are a million dead people in Rwanda who might have been alive even with a fairly moderate response. We're not talking about a massive invasion from the West. We're talking about a couple of brigades, experts on the ground thought, from NATO probably could have put a stop to the violence within a day or two, because the violence wasn't by it was by mobs. It was neither terrorists who were running and hiding, nor guerrillas, nor an organized military response. It was simply mob violence. And yet there are a million corpses because we did nothing.
You mentioned that President Obama's just war ideology may hold a somewhat surprising tenet that it's never possible to wage a just war against the United States.
Yeah. And the best way to think about that, consider the following. Now, the way that we have fought the war on terror, especially under President Obama, has very heavily relied on the use of our Predator drones and Reaper drones to fire missiles remotely at base camps, at people we hope are terror leaders and so on. And that has been defended by the State Department and by international law experts within the administration as an entirely legitimate form of warfare. So the question you have to ask if you really believe in moral conversation about war is, what if the other side did it? What if Al-Qaeda or the Taliban had Predator drones or Reaper drones and was sending them even now toward the United States? Would we feel that is an unjust or a just method of warfare? I take it we'd feel that it's unjust. That's the sort of thing I'm talking about.
Well, you call this the American proviso. Attacking America is different from being attacked by America. But we have done all sorts of reprehensible things in our past. There was the Mexican War. There was the Spanish-American War. There was the repression of people in the Philippines, overthrows of governments over the years. But we are always in the right, according to the Obama concept of just war?
I don't think that President Obama would say we're always in the right, but he does stand in a tradition of American leaders who takes the view that there is something immoral about making war against the United States. It's not just politically bad, that it's just somehow morally wrong to fight us. And you're right. We have fought wars in a history for bad reasons. We fought wars for good reasons. World War II, the Civil War, some might the Revolutionary War. I would even say the War of 1812. We fought wars for good reasons and bad. But here's something about war that we don't talk about enough. Even when we fought wars for good reasons, terrible things have sometimes happened. Prisoners being killed in World War II and Vietnam, for example. Pick any war you want. Massacres by troops on both sides in the Civil War. Pick any war you want, and you'll see terrible things always happen in war. One of the things I think the media could do for us, it's not so much to focus on them when they happen, that we should be told, they shouldn't be hidden. But when we're getting ready to go to war, when we're so passionate and gearing up to start a new war and having that argument, one of the things I think the media could really do is remind us in a thoughtful, nonpartisan way, if you're going to fight a war, terrible things will happen, and a few of them at least will be done by your own side. You have to accept that as a cost of war if you want to fight.
Actually, we only punish the journalists who have encouraged us to go to war after the fact. Judith Miller, for example. You argue that although President Obama wants to make a distinction between the war in Afghanistan and the Iraq war, with one being just, the other not, they're actually more similar than he's willing to acknowledge.
I do think there's a similarity between the two wars, and they both cause the same, for me at least, and for a lot of just war theorists, both wars have the same difficulty. The question is, both wars were justified by the Bush administration as wars in our self-defense. Now, retrospectively, not a lot of people think Iraq was getting ready to attack us. The question is about Afghanistan is whether we were really about to be attacked anymore by al-Qaeda. Maybe we were at the time, but al-Qaeda tended to take many years between attacks, as it were. Now, with the war on terror, we're tracking terror leaders. We're trying to blow them up with remote missiles and so on, mostly missing them. And maybe they're all planning attacks on us. Maybe they're not. It's clear that the government, even this administration, is in effect saying, trust us. We know who the bad guys are, and we will get them. If you just trust us and sit back and let us do the work.
My guest is Stephen L. Carter, William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Law at Yale. His latest book, The Violence of Peace, America's Wars in the Age of Obama, published by Beast Books. You write that the main goal of the war on terror and the war in Afghanistan is prevention, and that this means information as opposed to punishment is the main tool of war. Well, how does this reliance on information shape Obama's war strategy?
It's an interesting puzzle for whoever sits in the White House. One of the things that I think happened to Obama when he became president was he began to have a deeper understanding than he had as a candidate or as a senator of the threats facing America. I really think he believes, as his predecessor did, that there are a lot of people out there who genuinely mean us ill and have the means to commit ill. I think it's one of the reasons that some of the attacks on his predecessor may have been a little bit overblown, is you see Obama really believing in the end a lot of the same things. But if you believe that, if you believe there are people out there who mean us ill, and if your strategy is, as President Obama has said, like President Bush, to stop them before they can do it, you need good intelligence. You need good information. That's the war on terror is largely based on. It's getting information about who's going to launch an attack and stopping them in time.
And this leads us to the whole debate over whether torture is an appropriate way of getting that information. Dick Cheney will argue yes. There are some experts, especially from the FBI, who say that it's a very poor way to gain intelligence. But we are still, I assume, engaged in some acts of torture.
Yeah, in the last election, 2008, President Obama and Senator McCain both argued vehemently against using any form of torture or physical coercion to get information. And I think I meant that quite sincerely. But since President Obama's election, there still have been a number of cases of people captured on the battlefield and sent to other countries for interrogation. Now, the president appointed a commission that was charged with finding ways to make sure that when we send people to other countries, they don't get tortured. But if you look at the commission's recommendations, they're pretty weak. They have to do with things like making sure we monitor the practices. And so it is widely believed by experts that there's a fair amount of this going on. In particular, a lot of the people who've been captured have been sent to Pakistan. People have been captured on the battlefield in Afghanistan and sent to Pakistan. And no one has any illusions, I think, about what happens to prisoners being interrogated in Pakistan. And evidently, by some reports, there's still good intelligence flowing out of those prisons. But there's still an enormous cost to us to use that strategy to get intelligence. Not only a cost in the sense of torture as a recruiting tool, but also a cost in a different sense, that it does something to our psyche, I think, to become people who are willing to do those things.
You write in the book about an Iraq war veteran who was in the audience when you were discussing this book, and he said he was uncomfortable going off to war for a theory. What did you say to him?
He did say that. I was talking about the book here in New York at the Yale Club, I was talking about the theory of just and unjust war, and he got up and he talked about how he'd seen friends of his killed in the war, and he had killed people in the war, and he didn't like the idea of fighting for somebody's theory. And I think we can all understand that. On the other hand, there's a sense in which every war is for theory. If you're fighting for self-defense, for home and hearth, for your country, for justice, you're always fighting for an idea in the end. And what's important is to create the space, and here again I think the media could help us, create the space for thoughtful, reflective conversation about ideas. Just a few minutes ago, you and I had a brief exchange about this. You asked me if I would have sent troops to Rwanda during the genocide there. My answer is yes. I think genocide is something worth fighting against. Well, that's an idea. We can debate whether I'm right or wrong about that. But I would like to see presidents thinking in those terms, thinking in terms of what's right and wrong to fight about.
The conflict in Afghanistan has dragged on for almost a decade now. When does just war theory say we should end a war?
In order for war to be just, one thing that has to be clear is what would count as winning. And that's in part so the other side can decide when to surrender. And one of the things I would really like to hear President Obama talk about is exactly that. He's talked about how important the war is. He's talked about how essential it is. I would like to see a clear articulation of this would mean victory. And when this happens, we can stop fighting. And then we can evaluate his idea about what counts as victory.
I wonder if we'll see in a time, any time in the near future when we'll be at peace again.
I think the war on terror is going to drag on for some time. I've been reading some articles lately about what the intelligence community calls the baby bin Ladens, the young terror leaders who are coming along, of which there are a lot. And I think there's reason to think the war on terror with the baby bin Ladens coming along is going to go on for some years to come.
Stephen L. Carter is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Law at Yale. He is also a contributor to the Daily Beast, and that's probably the reason that his latest book, A Return to Nonfiction, is published by Beast Books. It's called The Violence of Peace, America's Wars in the Age of Obama. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me back.